This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast.
The Hidden Killers Podcast.
With Tony Bruschi.
As we continue to listen and try to understand the trial of Thomas Randolph, there was a day without a trial, so we don't have any new audio for you today directly from the courtroom, but we do have a lot of other audio from you for you that you probably have not heard yet, including some of the audio of the tour that Thomas gave police of his home, one of the most bizarre, I think, videos I have seen in quite some time. We'll be playing that back for you shortly, but first I want to go back to earlier in the week and take a listen exclusively to the prosecution's opening arguments in the case against Thomas Randolph.
State, are you prepared to give your opening statement?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence will show in this case that it is really, really hard to plan the perfect murder. In this case, you will learn that on May 8th, 2008, specifically at 8:45 p.m., the defendant calls 911. What you're seeing over here on this monitor is 6517 Rancho Santa Fe. This is Sharon's home, a home that she invited the defendant to move into and live with her. When police arrive, there are three people inside that residence. And you will learn two are dead. This is the defendant's wife, Sharon Randolph. She was shot in the head in the hallway just outside of her master bedroom. And there was this man who was shot multiple times. And lastly, we get to this man. That's the defendant. That's what the defendant looked like 15 years ago. This excerpt, this still that you see, is from a walkthrough that he gives to the police 1 week after the murder, where he, in his own words, tells the police exactly what happened. What you're looking at here is a crime scene diagram. This is important just in terms of orienting some of the stuff that is in this house. Right there is where Sharon's body was found. You can see her head is kind of almost into the master bedroom. You can see there is a hallway that goes straight to that second body. That is the hallway that leads to the garage. And this is where the second man is found. This area, and in particular the northeast bedroom, the office, is important for worrying ourselves about some of the things the defendant says happened on that night. You will learn that the defendant will tell police that he and Sharon had been in Utah for the entire week essentially before this, tending to his father. His father was ill, and the two of them were gone for an entire week, leaving the house empty. He will tell you that the very next day from the day Sharon is killed, on May 9th, they plan to leave the state again and return to Utah to take care of his father. You will hear on that night of May 8th, the defendant and Sharon go to dinner at the Santa Fe to a steakhouse called the Charcoal Grill. They were going to celebrate Mother's Day early because they were going to be away in Utah and Sharon wouldn't have an opportunity to be with her daughter Colleen or her grandkids. You're going to hear, according to the defendant, they planned after dinner to see a movie, but decided to cut the movie short so they could come home early to have sex. He will tell you that before they got home, they went from the Santa Fe to a gas station that you're going to see is right next to the Santa Fe to fill up the tank because they were leaving the very next morning. That gas station, you'll learn, is called Funny's. He will tell the police that when they pulled up to the garage, it's essentially a two-car garage, but it's really tight. There's a car already parked inside, and it would be really difficult for him to pull all the way in and have Sharon exit from the front passenger side. So when he pulls up, Sharon exits first, with the defendant in the driver's seat remaining in the car. He will tell you that he pulls in, waits in the car, and gets the car into that its slot. The defendant will tell police that he didn't hear anything for two main reasons. He tells the police that he's essentially deaf, and also he had the car turned up for music really loud. So he doesn't hear anything. Sharon goes inside, and he hears nothing without incident. You will learn that he says that when he opens the door to the garage, he sees Sharon at the end of that hallway, lying face down. He tells the police, "I thought I saw a shadow kind of farther down the hallway near Sharon." So he gets nervous. So he goes into that side bedroom, the one that I had pointed out on the crime scene diagram, and he reaches for a gun that's kind of hanging in one of these like almost like shoe closets. You know, they look like rectangles, and you can slot things in. So he reaches in and he grabs his gun, and as he makes his way out to that doorway of the bedroom, to that hallway to get back towards Sharon, an intruder bumps into him, comes his way right into him. And you're going to learn that that intruder was wearing a black ski mask. And he was wearing a sweatshirt, a baggy sweatshirt. The defendant tells the police at that point in time, he had no idea who the intruder was. He explains that he notices the intruder starts to struggle for a firearm out of his baggy clothing. And so what he says he does is he pushes the intruder on the opposite end of the hallway from that doorway. He pushes him across, and then he pulls out his gun and starts to shoot at the intruder multiple times in that, essentially, at that doorway and in that hallway. He explains that as he's shooting at this intruder, the intruder starts to kind of make his way down towards the garage door, right? The way to get out. Even though the garage door is closed, he claims that's the way the intruder decided to run. And he follows and continues to shoot. And ultimately, he continues to shoot until the intruder falls down dead just inside the garage, right at the entryway of the garage door. And then the defendant, when he kind of, and it was all kind of done, he discovers that the intruder is none other than his handyman, Michael Miller. The defendant then tells the police this: "I immediately call the police." The evidence will show that when the defendant recounts what happens, he is the hero of his own story. He comes in, he sees his wife killed, and then takes out the intruder. However, the evidence in this case will show that the defendant's story does not add up. You will learn there are a lot of problems with the defendant's versions of events. Problem number one: the evidence will show that the scene tells a very different story. The evidence will show he claims that he shot Miller in the hallway of his house multiple times. You will learn this not only through the walkthrough, but Mr. Randolph gives an interview the early morning hours of May 9th, because this happens on May 8th. We kind of blend over up past midnight. He's giving an interview. So right after it happens, he's essentially telling this same story that he tells 1 week later in the walkthrough. And then about a month later on June 3rd, he does another interview where he's recounting essentially very similar details about what happens. But he is very consistent that that shooting happens in the hallway. You will now see a few of these excerpts. You're going to get a chance to watch his interview on May 9th, his walkthrough that happens on the 15th, and his second interview on June 3rd. You'll get to see it all. And I hope, as you do this, you'll take good notes about the things that he is saying. But here's a couple of things that you will eventually learn through the course of trial.
Did you fire again in this hallway?
Yeah, I believe so. Okay. I believe so. Like I said, I fired a lot, and then he came out and turned around again.
Okay, now, is he in the garage now?
He's right at the doorway there. I think he was trying to open the garage door. Yeah, in the garage, and heard a noise. I'd already turned around to go back to work, Sharon, and I started to, and I heard a noise, and I just assumed it was him. It was loud, and I turned around, shot it again once or twice, and he was laying there. I wasn't able to go anywhere, and I shot him again. But it was the fire extinguisher had fallen off the refrigerator, and I just remember hearing the noise. And
how close were you to Mike when he fired?
I don't know that he fired.
When you fired?
Me to you, probably. Either one of you. Just as soon as I could get enough distance to... I mean, he was right up in my face, like he was reaching, trying to... I thought I was trying to get him again, but that was...
So you're indicating about 3 feet?
Yeah, if even that. We was close. I could hit him just as easy, but that's, I don't fight. I got this fat back neck thing, and I swing at you, and I might just be standing there still swinging at you tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
So. And this was in the house still?
Yeah, right around that bedroom door.
These, you'll learn, are excerpts from his walkthrough, where again, he's recounting the very thing that he tells the police about what allegedly happened that night.
As we got up in here, he kind of rushed up on me a little bit, and that's when I just pushed him, boom, boom, boom! He started going out toward the shed. I don't know how many times I shot him, but I just kept right on going. Boom! 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 And he just lay in there. Just lay in there, enough. And when I heard that noise, it really did scare me. I'm like, boom! Boom! Except the door didn't come down. It stayed just like it was open. And I actually got close. Boom! Boom!
You will learn, when crime scene analysts process that scene, there is not a single bullet strike in the hallway. What I mean by that is there's not an impact mark. There's nothing on the wall. There's nothing on the floor. There's nothing on the ceiling. Zilch. You will learn there's not a single drop of blood in that area of the hallway. Not even a drop. Despite the fact the defendant said he shot boom, 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 over and over and over again in that hallway. And you will learn there is only one casing found in the hallway. But where it's found is right at the lip of the door that goes into the garage. Almost essentially where the defendant said he was standing when he kind of did those last couple boom, booms at the end. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the very hallway that the defendant claims he shot Mr. Miller in. As you can see, and you look and the evidence will show, there's no apparent blood. There don't appear to be any casings except for that one right there. That's it. But this is where the defendant claims this fire, his shooting of Mr. Miller occurred. But when the police and CSA start to process the garage, that is where they start to find bullets. That is where they start to find a lot of casings. And the evidence will show that, unlike what he said, the evidence, this physical evidence, will show that the shooting actually occurs in the garage, not in the hallway. You will learn that 4 of the 5 bullets are found inside the garage. The only other bullet was found inside Mr. Miller. You will learn that 4 of the 5 casings are found well into the garage. And the only other casing is found right at that lip of the doorway in the hallway that you've seen. This is the garage of Sharon and Tom Randall. This is Sharon's vehicle. To the right is Tom's vehicle. The vehicle on the right is the one that he said that he drove in on that night. As you can see over here, that is the doorway. That is the doorway that the defendant kind of leans over and does the final shot, right? That's where he claims this all concludes. This area over here, all the way to the left, is where one of the casings is found. Despite the fact that the shooting happened all the way in the hallway, one of the casings is found here. The second casing is found near Mr. Randolph's car on the opposite wall. There's that same door, and that's casing number two. You will learn that the third casing they locate is the one that we've seen, right at the doorway of the hallway. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the bullets. It's found in front of Mr. Randolph's SUV. This bullet is found underneath the SUV. And these two bullets, 10 and 11, are found in Mr. Miller's clothing. So when they move Mr. Miller, they kind of roll out of his clothing. You will learn, as I had said, that there's a walkthrough that's conducted about a week after Ms. Randolph, Sharon and Mr. Miller are killed. During this walkthrough, in addition to doing the walkthrough, crime scene analyst named Randall McPhail, or Randy, comes in to do some additional processing, in part to process the blood spatter in the area where Sharon is killed, because she receives a headshot, spreads up on the walls, and so he's there to process that. When he is there a week later, there are two more casings that they locate, and again, they're found in the garage. In this area over here, one of them is found in this green toolbox. And the other one was by that water heater. Oops, right over here. If I can go back. Problem number two, the ski mask. This is what Mr. Randolph has to say about the ski mask on Mr. Miller's head.
I was actually in the room, and he came in, and kind of we bumped into each other, and he had his had the mask down, but it wasn't on. He told me it was black. Because it wasn't all the way down. It was like maybe the ear or something, like maybe it pushed it up.
I might have pushed his mask up because I'm taller when they came in here.
Well, but just pushing it down, he's short.
Pardon me?
You'd be pushing it down, not up, right?
Well, I'd be pushing it kind of sideways. I wasn't like knocking it off or anything with my hands.
So probably hit him in the back of the head? Could you tell it was Mike yet?
I knew it was Mike because of his chin. But I don't know if he had his mask on then. It seems like he still had his mask on then.
He had his mask on when you were
Yeah, he had his mask on there for sure.
Well, when you're back here, when you're back here and you squared off on, you still had his mask on?
Yeah.
And then when he went between him now turning and you continuing to shoot and him going to the ground, he still got his mask on.
I think so. And as I remember, the mask wasn't all the way down. It was like rolled up one row about right here. Mm-hmm. As I remember it.
And that interview there, that's the one on June 3rd. So that's interview number two, just for context. What you're going to learn is that he only describes Miller's mask being off kind of after the shooting is done. Throughout his different interviews and in the walkthrough, he will never describe a distinctive process of, I watched Miller totally remove this mask. And so here's the issue. That's where Mr. Miller is found. The defendant says he nudges him at some point to roll him over. And this mask is found over at the kind of the passenger side of the Randolph car, Mr. Randolph's car, right? So if you're facing the garage door, it's to the left. Here's the thing with that ski mask. There's no bullet holes in it. And there's no blood in it. And that's a problem because Mr. Miller was shot multiple times in the head. There are several entry-exit wounds. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a trajectory rod. which will show you the pathway of one of the bullets that went through Mr. Miller's brain, which would be difficult to not have a hole in the mask if it's sitting on your head. You will learn throughout the course of this trial that another problem is the trajectories of the bullets that pass through Mr. Miller's body, not just through the head, don't match up with what the defendant says occurred. Problem number four. You'll learn that the defendant repeatedly tells the police he never heard any gunshots because he's hard of hearing.
Okay. And did you hear anything?
Didn't I have the radio on, or she had the radio on? That's pretty loud because I don't hear. I don't definitely hear.
Okay.
That took a few minutes because I was at the garage door and my shirt comes down.
When you were out of the truck, did you hear anything inside the house?
Didn't hear a thing.
Did you ever hear the shots before you went inside the house? Did you ever hear any shots?
I didn't hear anything, but that's, I'm really deaf.
The evidence will show that's not what Mr. Randolph told 911.
Is he alone?
Yes, Wells Fargo. No, I didn't. I just heard shots.
I just heard shots. Those are the words of the defendant you will learn at 8:45 p.m. Mere seconds or minutes after this all unfolds. I just heard shots. His words. Problem number five. You will learn that the defendant, based on all the evidence, waited 12 minutes after Sharon is shot to call 911 and get help. 12 minutes. Well, how do we get to that point? Well, the evidence is going to show this. There's four components to this issue. The first is a gas station video. The second is a neighbor. The third is a 911 call. And the fourth is the defendant's statements to police. You will learn that the defendant says, instead of going to see the movie after dinner, they're going home to have sex. And before they do, they go to Funny's gas station.
When you leave the casino, do you go directly home?
No, we started to, and then we went to Funny's. So it's called Funny's gas station on the corner there. There's a gas station there, not just around the corner. And she said, "Be very good gas now because it's going to go up tonight because of the weekend, over the weekend." So we stopped and filled up with gas, and I think that was it. And we went home.
And you're going to learn that the police take that statement and they follow up on it. And you're going to learn that they go to Funny's gas station. And sure enough, they find this footage here. At 8:22, if you look all the way over there on the right, that, you will learn, is Mr. Randolph's SUV pulling in. I think they get a receipt also from that to confirm that a transaction was done to kind of pump that gas. And you're going to see that at 8:26, Mr. Randolph and Sharon leave, just like he said. They filled up gas and they made their way home. p.m. You're going to learn that when they leave at 8:26 p.m., you're going to learn from the detectives as well as from Google Maps that really it's only a 3 to 4 minute drive home from Funny's. This is an overhead map. What you're looking over there is all the way down there, starting at that blue dot at the bottom, that's Funny's gas station. You look at that big structure on the left, that's the Santa Fe Casino. All you have to do is kind of go up Rancho, hang a quick right, make a right up Rancho Santa Fe, and voila, you are at Sharon and Tom's home, right? Google Maps says it's 4 minutes. You're going to hear from detectives who actually drove the route. It said they took 3 minutes. But bottom line is, if he's leaving at 8:26, the evidence will show he should have arrived home about 8:30. Well, that brings us to the neighbor, Mark Bartlett. The evidence will show that Mark Bartlett was actually in his garage at that time. What you see here is, there is the defendant's home, 6517 Rancho Santa Fe, and if you follow the little dots, that's Mark Bartlett's house. You're going to learn that this is the vantage point from Mark's house looking at the Randolph house, and it's the house with the big palm tree to its left. So it's the dark brown garage. That's the Randolph house. That's the vantage point from the Randolph house looking at Mark's house, right? That's the distance. Mark Bartlett's going to testify that, yeah, I was their neighbor. I lived at 5200 Dana Springs. He's going to tell you that at around 8:30 at night, he's in his garage. He's working on his car. Garage door is open, and he actually notices and hears the Randolph vehicle pulling in, because he actually says it catches my attention. I actually look over. I watch them pull in. I watch the garage close. He's going to tell you he's on the phone with his buddy, and he starts to hear gunshots. Multiple gunshots ring out at around 8:30 at night. And then he's going to tell you that he's so kind of shocked by it, he tells his friend, like, hey, yo, there's shooting going on right over there at the neighbor's house. And then he's going to tell you that, here's the thing, even though he heard those shots around 8:30 at night, the cops don't show up until 20 minutes later. Around 8:50, that's when he remembers police showing up, 20 minutes after he hears the shots. So police, you will learn, do a little digging, some follow-up. You're going to hear that they get his phone records. And what they see is, sure enough, at 8:33, he's on the phone with his friend Alex. Right at the time that he said he heard those shots. So here's the deal. What does the defendant tell the police when they ask him, hey, from start to finish, like when you pulled in and saw what happened to Sharon and the encounter with the intruder and you did the shooting, how long did that all take you to finally pick up the phone and call 911? And these are the defendant's words.
Oh, got ahead of myself. Hold on a second.
So all told, how long do you think it took from the time you opened the door to you being on 911? You had mentioned before that you thought it was a lot quicker than obviously walking through it. 2-3 minutes, maybe.
2 to 3 minutes for this all to unfold and hit up, get on the phone with 911. Here's the problem. The defendant, you will learn, leaves the gas station at 8:26. Based on the pathway, the evidence will show he should have arrived home at 8:30. You will learn that Bartlett hears the calls around 8:30, and his records show 8:33. However, you will learn the defendant does not call 911 until 8:45 p.m., which would mean, according to the evidence, that Sharon would have been lying in that hallway minute after minute after minute, suffering from a gunshot wound to the head. Problem number 6. You're going to learn this is a troubled marriage. This is Tom and Sharon on their wedding day. You will learn that in the summer of 05, they meet on a dating site on the internet. You're going to learn that around January of 06, the defendant moves from Utah to Sharon's house. You will learn that on January 16th, the defendant is signing up Sharon for a life insurance policy, $100,000. You will learn that 2 weeks after that, he signs up Sharon for another life insurance policy for another $200,000. You will learn that around March of 2006, they go to Mexico to have kind of a wedding ceremony. You're going to learn that it's not official. They're not technically legally married from the ceremony, but it's kind of a wedding nonetheless. And by March of 2007, they legally marry in Las Vegas. This, ladies and gentlemen, are copies of the insurance policy for $100,000, where Mr. Randolph is the 100% beneficiary of the policy. Even though the evidence will show that Sharon has a daughter, grandkids, and this is signed on January 16th of 06. Here's another policy for $200,000. You'll even see that there is another policy from Stonebridge that he makes a claim on after Sharon dies. There's at least 3 policies. You will learn from people that family and friends that is right after they get married, one of the things that they did was pick out his or her urns and you're going to hear from Sharon's family and friends. And they're going to tell you from jump, they were really concerned about this relationship. They were very concerned. You're going to hear a little bit about Sharon. She had been married for a long time. Her husband passed away from cancer. And what you'll hear from people is that Sharon didn't want to ever be alone. She was kind of terrified of it. But time after time at different stages, they felt, family and friends, like, this is going too fast. You shouldn't be bringing this guy in. Doing all this. It gets so bad, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to hear from at least one witness where they legitimately believe that the defendant might kill her, and they warned her. They warned her. And you will learn that Sharon didn't listen. And then there's the other woman, Liz Labrador. You will learn that the defendant, while married to Sharon, had a girlfriend who lived out of state, and her name was Liz.
Everybody knew about Lizzie.
Why? Because he didn't make it a secret. He would tell people about his girlfriend. You will hear from family members of Sharon that heard him talking about his girlfriend while married to Sharon in front of them. You can imagine they weren't necessarily a fan of that. You're going to learn that he dated this woman before he met Sharon, while he dated Sharon, during his marriage to Sharon, after Sharon. And you're going to learn that this is a huge issue in the marriage that causes Sharon great pain. Great pain. And you're going to learn, through the course of this fairly short marriage, that the defendant would leave her repeatedly. I'm leaving you. Not just like, I'm just taking off, like, we're done, I'm out, I'm leaving, and I'm going to go be with Lizzie. He packed up his stuff and go in a U-Haul and literally move in and then kind of come back. And there was this real yo-yo back and forth. And you're going to hear about how much pain that caused Sharon. Where you're going to learn, like, she struggled with, I think maybe I should get a divorce. This isn't great.
Otherwise, that's really weird. I go out and fuck another woman, and she forgave me for that. At the time that I was going to give Pauline $100 to go to England, she says, if you give her that money, I swear to God, I'll divorce you tomorrow. I mean, and there was no doubt in my mind she meant it hurt.
That is a description of the defendant talking about Sharon and how she felt about infidelity versus giving her daughter some money. Colleen, you'll learn, is Sharon's daughter. You will learn, the evidence will show from the witnesses that knew Sharon best, him being with Liz and another woman was far more painful than giving her daughter $100. But this is one of the ways the defendant frames his relationship in an interview to the police.
And that's where I met Sharon. Her husband died of cancer a year later, and mine died a year earlier. I was on the internet by then, and I was just, me and Lizzie fight all the time. Fought for 2 days and fight for five. That just ain't fun, so.
And this is the defendant, how he kind of explains the timing of it, right? He's saying, you know, Sharon had just lost her husband, and then I was kind of dating Lizzie at the time, but his relationship with her is kind of, you know, fuck for five, or what is it, fuck for two, fight for five, whatever it was, you know. So even he's kind of explaining a very similar kind of timeline on this. But in this trial, ladies and gentlemen, you're not just going to hear from Sharon's friends and family. You're going to get to hear from Liz. She's going to confirm, yeah, we were dating during his marriage to Sharon. So I apologize about the typo on that. She will explain that they saw each other regularly. You're going to learn that the defendant, from her end, he was going back and forth. The same kind of yo-yo, she's going to tell you, yeah, that was what was happening. I'm going to be with you, I got to go back. You're going to learn that while he dated Liz, he also took out a $150,000 life insurance policy on her. You're going to learn that 50% was going to go to the defendant, and 50% was going to go to her daughter, Tina. And you're going to learn that's how he pitched it. He was like, I'll pay for everything. but you should have some peace of mind for your daughter, a woman that he's dating. And you're going to hear from Liz's perspective. I'm like, well, it seemed like free money. So I was fine with it. You're going to learn that around February 2008, probably around Valentine's Day, you're going to learn that Liz is kind of tired of the back and forth. And you're going to hear that roughly around that time, she gives the defendant an ultimatum, which is basically, listen, you really just have to choose. Like, you either pick Sharon or pick me, but you really just have to pick one of us. And you're going to hear that defendant, you know, he'll figure things out with how to end it with Sharon. Agendas and motives. And that was something opposing counsel had mentioned during voir dire, and I thought that was kind of something interesting, so I just jotted it down. Because I felt like when you listen to the evidence in this case, it's really applicable to the defendant. Because in this case, the defendant had an agenda and a motive. Problem number 7. Defendant's strange relationship with Michael Miller. You're going to learn that in February of 2008, same month, roughly, that he is getting an ultimatum from Liz, the defendant just happens to meet Michael Miller. You're going to learn that the evidence will show the defendant's description of the circumstance of them meeting and connecting up is strange. Let's talk about the defendant and his handyman. And I definitely put that in air quotes. The evidence will show that the defendant sees Mr. Miller at a gas station buying a 40-ounce of beer. You're going to hear that according to the defendant, his first impression of Miller is, I think that guy has a drug problem. You're then going to hear, after having that impression, the defendant decides to buy this total stranger that very beer. The defendant will tell you, though, as I'm leaving the gas station, I noticed that strange guy who I had never met before walking down the street. And you know what the defendant decides to do? You're going to hear he pulls over. And he invites the stranger into his car. Are you going my way? Are literally the very words the defendant uses to the police. That's what I said. Hey, you going my way? Come on in. And you're going to learn, according to the defendant, I drove him home. We talked for a while, for an hour, outside of his house. You'll learn he was from South Carolina. He moves here to Vegas because he's looking for money. He's living with his aunt and his uncle, and he's trying to get on his feet. And you're going to hear that he talks to them for outside an hour. And then, at the end of this hour, he decides to call him up and offer him a job as a handyman for his house. Agendas and motives. Here is what the defendant talks about. This is him recounting, in his own words, this meeting.
So you've known him 4 or 5 months. How did you meet him?
At a convenience store, I said, they're getting my car. It was a terrible sense. I was getting my car washed and sweating. And I was just in there just waiting. He was in line before me getting a beer. And it was like he'd been doing, you know, manual labor because he was all dirty and stuff. But there was 2 or 3 people in line. And he just kind of joked and said, this lady, she's been asking for ID. She does it every time. I come here every day and buy beer. She always asks me for ID. And something down, I think I don't have it or something. Anyway, so I said, well, don't worry, I'll just get it for you. So I just paid for the beer and I just didn't get it for this. And he said, no, that one's yours. I'm getting this. So that's the kind I want or something.
When you first met him, did you ever have, inkling that he may have had some kind of drug problem?
Well, yeah, obviously he's black and didn't have a job and was buying a 40-ounce or whatever they call them. Just chit-chatted there and he took off and then I got my car down and I was going toward the house, and I seen him along there, just pull over his day, need a ride, going my way, and sure, so I was there, just popped in and sat over in front of his house the first time for probably an hour and just talked.
So do you engage him to come over to the house and do some work for you?
We I talked about doing something. Excuse me, and he says, "I'll gladly help you if you need some help. I ain't got nothing else to do." And I called him and asked him if he really wanted to work. And he said, "Yeah, he'd come over." He said he's not good at what he does, but he's a good worker. He works consistently. And it's not like going down and getting a couple of snacks on the morning.
So how often does he come over to your house and go to work?
A lot, a lot. He's also come over a lot just to watch ball games, and he's ate dinner with us two or three times.
And if you catch it, you may not have caught it, but the evidence would show he says right in that statement, "I called him. I called him to invite him to work." Well, you're going to learn the police gathered the defendant's phone records, his cell phone records, as well as his home records. And you're going to learn that first phone call happens on February 16th, 2008, right in the month of February. You're going to learn through the course of these interviews that one of the strange things in terms of the evidence is the defendant consistently describes Mr. Miller as a poor worker. A poor worker. And yet, you will hear him also say, almost always in the very same breath, he is constantly having him back over to do more work. And you will hear him say, "I was repeatedly paying him money. I was loaning him money," for someone who apparently couldn't work. And you're going to hear from other friends and family of Sharon who also kind of observed, like, it was weird. They were hung out all the time, but they basically, like, didn't do anything. It was weird. You'll hear about a whole roof thing, this roof project that never gets worked on. But it's the big thing they're going to do, but, like, it never gets done.
What about Mike?
He's bummed. He's a bum, but he's a nice guy. I mean, he's... I mean, I knew he was a bum.
How about Mike? What do you mean, how about Mike? What would his shortcoming be?
He didn't work, and I don't know why, because he supposedly had all these job offers. That's why we had him there, is to lift shit and lift boxes and do work. He couldn't drive a nail, he couldn't put a screw in to save his life.
Couldn't do those things to save his life. And yet, day after day, the evidence will show this gentleman over here keeps having him come over to do more work and give him more money. The evidence is going to show over the course of the 2.5 months, what is happening here is the defendant is grooming Mr. Miller for the ultimate payoff. Just kill my wife, give you a portion of the money. I mentioned that they acquired his records. And you will learn, when you just look at the records, it indicates this is not a normal handyman-customer relationship. The first phone call happens on February 21st, 2018. I misspoke, I apologize. And between February 21st and May 8th, 2008, they call each other hundreds of times. You're going to learn that this guy's like basically number two of all the people in the universe that he's calling. You're going to find out number one's his girlfriend. But it's a strange thing for someone who's just a handyman. And you're going to hear from Miller's family too, as well as Sharon's family. And they're all going to testify about this working relationship. And I definitely put that in air quotes. It was strange and concerning to many people on either side of the fence. The Miller family didn't like it. The Randolph family thought it was strange. You will learn that they essentially never do any work, but they hang out all the time. There are times where they kind of, there are people in the house, and then they kind of duck off to just talk in private. You're going to hear that the Miller's family repeatedly warned him, "You need to stop hanging out with that guy. There's a big age gap. They don't really kind of cross over in the same kind of news and hang out." You're going to hear that the defendant doesn't have like a lot of friends or social network, and Miller's in a new town and he doesn't really know anybody, and now they're essentially inseparable. You're going to learn that the defendant took his handyman out shooting. You're going to learn that he invited his handyman out for date nights with Sharon. He even came over for the Easter dinner that occurred just about 2 weeks maybe 3 weeks before Sharon is murdered. But ultimately, when you listen to all of the evidence in this case, what's going to be clear is there is a conspiracy here. The evidence will show that the defendant's motive was not just insurance money, but he potentially stood to gain and inherit the house. You will learn that he targets and locates a person who is financially down on his luck. He brings him into the fold. And for weeks and months, he sustains him with money and loan for the ultimate plan. The plan was to murder Sharon on that night. You will learn on his possession, Miller has a key to the residence that he enters through the back door. You'll hear the defendant has a variety of different explanations as to possibly how he got that. But the evidence will show Miller had a key to the house. The evidence will show that Miller was lying in wait for Sharon, while the defendant sat outside keeping his hands clean. Sharon walks in and is killed by Mr. Miller. You're going to learn that based on their pace of travel, because they were out of town, Sharon was not in that house the week leading up to her murder and was literally leaving back to Utah. This was the only window of time. And you're going to hear that on the day of the murder, the defendant spends basically the entire day with Michael Miller, running errands, looking at jet skis, going to a bank that they didn't quite get to because it gets closed. There's all sorts of things that they do during the day hanging out. So there's just this couple hour window of time. Dinner date with Sharon, the final dinner. And you're going to learn that essentially the payment will be some portion of this $300,000. That's what the circumstantial evidence will indicate. The payoff is that, which can only be gained if Sharon is killed. But ultimately you'll learn, when you think about agendas and motives, the end of evidence will show the defendant has one more trick up his sleeve. He kills Miller. The evidence will show that a name gives him a couple of things. The evidence show will paint him as a hero, take eyes off of him. The evidence will show that it will give him the entirety of the insurance money, so he doesn't have to share it with anyone. And it also does a third thing. It eliminates all direct witnesses to the conspiracy. As you listen to the evidence in this case, please keep an open mind. But there are things to look out for. As you listen to the evidence, pay close attention to the course of his demeanor through the course of the interviews. They are not the same. Pay close attention about the manner in which the defendant describes and talks about his wife. His body language, his tone, the things that he is doing. And it's not just in his interviews and in the walkthrough. Pay attention to the things he actually says on 911, because you will learn there are inconsistencies in his recollections. Pay close attention. He's not consistent. There are problems at every juncture, and we've only highlighted a few. We've got more. You'll hear those later. But at the end of the day, when you listen to all the witnesses and you hear the law, it will be very, very clear that it is very, very, very hard to plan the perfect murder. And at the end of the day, the defendant's story doesn't add up. And at the conclusion of this trial, we will ask you to find that man guilty for conspiring with Mr. Miller to kill his wife, and then ultimately finding him guilty for that murder as well as the murder of Michael Miller when he double-crosses him. Thank you very much.
This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast
with Tony Bruschi.